Time to take a look at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife. Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist, our guest today, Larry Mueller here. So happy to have you listening in. Certainly, if you want to join in with your own question, you are most welcome at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Give us a call. We'll be glad to put you on the air. Scott Craven, welcome back. Nice to have you with us again.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
Snow. We had a lot of snow across many parts of Wisconsin.
Really?
And it. Yeah.
I hadn't noticed the 10-foot piles around my house.
Did that have really have much of an impact on our wildlife?
Well, I don't think so, and I hope not. I haven't been hearing anything about adverse impacts. I'm sure there may have been a few individual animals here and there that may have been on the edge anyway, but just around my place where the snow drifted, something fierce and was quite deep, because it drifted and was hard-packed, you know, most things that I've been watching, like the pheasants that come into the back, are just walking on top of it.
Yeah.
Now, those that have to scratch through it to find food or whatnot may be a bit stressed, but a lot of the former agricultural fields or the crop fields that were left stubble blew clear in the drifting anyway. So
yeah.
I don't think, and the fact that it came late after an unusually mild start to the winter, and now it's supposed to be back in the 50s, I think what came before and what's going to come after will mitigate the impacts of that deep snow. Had it come early and stayed all winter, that would have been a different story.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, Sue in Duluth has a question, so let's go to Sue and see what's on her mind. Hi, Sue.
Hello. I'm always glad when Scott Craven's on. And I just wanted to say that I've been seeing a lot of things in the media here and there about wolves being savage and evil and worthy of being killed. And it seems to me that it's time for Farley Mo Watts' Never Cry Wolf Again. When that first came out, you know, it helped people see wolves in a more realistic way. And that seems to be being lost, and maybe we should campaign to have that mandatory in schools.
What do you think, Scott?
Well, it's an interesting book. I read it a long time ago, and it was certainly an eye-opener as far as the relationship of someone from outside wolf range being exposed to them for the first time, as opposed to the native peoples that he was living amongst who actually had lived with wolves and had a very different picture of where the wolves fit into things. But it's so, sure, to the point that people can resurrect that book or many other good pieces of literature that have a factual approach to wolves and wolf management, that's a good thing. And there are some really good books here in Wisconsin. Dick Thiel's books on the wolf management program in the state are very good.
Adrian's
working on a book. There's lots of stuff out there. The problem is wolves are one of those species for which there's also a great deal of misinformation. And there are also individuals and groups who have their own opinions that have been perhaps passed down in the family or born through unfortunate experience, like the death of a hunting dog or something like that. And it makes for a very interesting sociological phenomenon in terms of wolf management. But we just had it. It's a good segue at the state chapter of the Wildlife Society meeting here in Madison yesterday. The Timberwolf Alliance and the DNR jointly had a ceremony in the afternoon announcing and recognizing the upcoming delisting of the wolf in Wisconsin. That will take effect on this coming Monday. And essentially that returns management of the wolf population to the state and the Department of Natural Resources. And everybody there at that meeting, all the wildlife professionals certainly welcomed that as kind of the culmination of a success story and as a great new opportunity and chapter in terms of wolf management, in that we can now deal with the problems where they occur and deal with the opportunities where they occur. So I'm hoping that things will settle down a little bit in terms of wolf management.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Sue. Appreciate it. Arlene in Burlington, it's your turn. Hi, Arlene.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Yeah.
Calling. I live in Racine County on an inland lake, a small lake, and we have a swan family. And I know there's a controversy now about swans in Racine County. I don't even know what kind of swans these are, but I have this fear that they're going to be taken away, you know, and gone. And I just wondered if your guests could speak a little bit to that. I know there's an adoption policy if these are the wrong kinds of swans. I think that's a mute swan.
Mm-hmm.
but it just sounds draconian and almost impossible to achieve. And quite frankly, I don't want to lose my swans. I have so much pleasure watching those every year out on the lake, and this has really disturbed me. So I would like a response to that, and also what, as a resident, I can do about that. Thank you so much. Yep. I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Well, we've popped the lid off the can of worms now, Larry.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Well, the Arlene's concerns are in fact warranted, and the birds in question are in all probability mute swans, which are an exotic Eurasian species. It's another case like feral cats and assorted other exotic species that were brought here by humans. Well-meaning folks who wanted a swan on their estate or whatever, but as often happens with exotic wildlife, they don't stay where they were placed, and all of a sudden you have feral populations in places where they, A, don't belong from a natural or ecological standpoint, and B, have the potential to cause some ecological harm. And mute swans, although they're big, white, beautiful birds, certainly fall into that category biologically.
What do they do?
Well, they're very aggressive, for one thing. So they could, depending on where they are, they can be a bit of an aggression problem for people, although I would guess that the property owners on these lakes in southeastern Wisconsin would differ with that. But it has happened in some settings, but they can be very destructive of wetland habitats. They're very aggressive toward other native waterfowl in terms of displacing them and so forth during the nesting season. Swan decoys are even sometimes used in golf course ponds to simply scare away other waterfowl as a control strategy. So there are some serious ecological problems. And across the eastern United States, most states are in the middle of and deeply involved in programs to try and rein in the mute swan population, which has, compared to us, I mean, Maryland and some states along the Chesapeake Bay and so forth, it is a horrendous problem. We've been dealing with it quite effectively over the last few years, and over most of Wisconsin, the mute swan population has been pretty much eliminated and very successfully eliminated, but there is still a stronghold of mute swans in the southeastern part of the state and some folks who feel very strongly about protecting them. And the DNR board at a recent meeting has taken some action to essentially provide an exclusion area or sanctuary area, whatever you want to call it, where the removal program that's going on elsewhere will probably be held in abeyance. I can't tell you the details about that, but I'm sure the folks in the local area are aware of it. There's essentially areas that are excluded from the control program. Now, trying to decide what that means in terms of a value judgment is a little bit tricky. As I say, that's a heavily urbanized area compared to many parts of the state, and where the human footprint is large, perhaps the impacts are not what they might be somewhere else. You may recall up in Ashland, there used to be quite a population of mute swans there in the Fish Creek sloughs near Ashland.
Yep.
Those and other populations have been dramatically reduced, and in part, that's for also the good of the restoration program that's been going on concurrently for our native swan, which is the trumpeter swan, which has been a tremendously successful program. The trumpeters are doing well. I would argue that they're even more magnificent than the mute swans, both in appearance and in call, and the fact that they really belong here and should be restored to where they were formerly found. But again, the mute swans are somewhat of an impediment to that effort as well. So, I mean, that's the situation in a nutshell. It's one of those kind of nasty biopolitical problems when it comes to wildlife management. But at least I think at this point there's been some compromise to allow the birds to remain to a certain extent where they are highly regarded like this. But, you know, as a statewide situation, I'm all for seeing them controlled because they simply don't belong here.
And I guess people who want to see swans, maybe a good way to help that part of it would be to find ways to support the trumpeter swans.
Correct. And as I say, that program has been going very well back from, you know, it starts some 20 years ago when they started bringing trumpeter swan eggs down from Alaska to be hatched and released here in Wisconsin. And now we have a pretty healthy free-flying population, and it's growing, and things are looking really good. But again, the mute swans, the continuing presence of the mute swans were considered an obstacle for that program, but now it's at least an isolated problem. States to the east of us are still having a much greater struggle with it than we are.
Thanks, Arlene, for calling. Appreciate it. Don in Lake Nabagamon, it's your turn next. Don, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, good morning, Larry and Scott. A few weeks ago, or a couple months ago now, you talked about ravens at some length, and I couldn't phone in that day, but I've got a couple incidents I'd like to relate for your audience.
Okay.
The first one took place up here just northwest of Brule on a little hobby farm a coworker of mine owned. He was replacing some wooden fence posts one day when it occurred to him that his wristwatch was taking a beating from all the post driving and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So he took it off, put it on top of the last post he had set. And then you know what's coming.
I know what's coming.
Yeah. A bit later in the morning, he was some distance down the fence line, and he kind of paused to take a breather. And sure enough, just then a raven flew overhead with something shiny in its beak. Yeah, that's right.
Goodbye, Rolex.
Yeah, goodbye.
Oh, that's a great story.
He was cheap. It was probably a Timex.
Okay.
But the other one that I think is really fascinating, and this occurred one snowy winter, oh, God, I'm going to say 40 years ago now or more, on a small lake up here near Drummond. And at that time, as I recall, there was only one home on the lake on the north shore. And it was quite visible from a town road that skirted the southwest shore. And a friend who had occasion to drive by the lake with some regularity began to notice a gathering of ravens on the house's deck, which overlooked the lake. And on successive days, the birds would be there. They never dispersed. And he just suspected that these people were snowbirds, and before they left, they might have filled a bird feeder or whatever and left something else on the deck there for birds, squirrels, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, after a few days, when the birds still hadn't left, he noticed a different reflection off of the patio doors that opened onto the deck. And at that time, his curiosity peaked, and he walked up this drifted driveway. And I would guess, despite many years as a conservation warden, he has memories of wildlife interactions, but I don't think he was prepared for what he discovered. Now, these are the early patio doors, rather clumsy doors. You know,
mm-hmm.
they all had wood frames, no vinyl in those days.
Yep.
And the ravens had pecked away the wooden frame surrounding the lock mechanism on these patio doors.
Mm-hmm.
And this somehow had allowed the doors to open, and they glided open just wide enough for the birds to enter. Well, the living room turned into a raven playroom,
and apparently it
was one sight to behold. Well, later on, trying to piece the story together, we kind of figured that there was an owl. Now, I don't recall whether it was a mounted owl or an owl decoy on a fireplace mantle that was directly across the room from the patio doors. And, of course, the old enmity between owls, ravens, crows took over.
Wow.
And
I would have not wanted to do the cleanup in that home after
Yeah, it was quite a sight.
It sounds like Hitchcock's The Birds in real life. Well, those are both very interesting stories. They certainly do have longstanding dislike for owls mm-hmm. and so forth, as do the crows. So those are both very interesting stories. Thank you.
Thanks, Don. Thanks a lot for calling. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, Larry Mueller here. If you have a question or comment for Scott, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Give a call. Before we go back to the phones, I just want to go back to that farm bill I mentioned at the top of the hour as to what impact the farm bill is actually going to have on our wildlife efforts and our wildlife life here in Wisconsin. Any thoughts, Scott?
Well, it's a great question, and I think the jury is still out because historically the Farm Bill has been a huge boon to wildlife because of the conservation provisions within the Farm Bill, programs like Conservation Reserve and Wetland Reserve and so on and so forth, and a variety of habitat enhancement programs. However, in the new Farm Bill, there are a couple of issues. One is that some of these conservation programs are apparently threatened with being streamlined or eliminated. That's one issue. The other issue is this rush toward biofuel production, which has a variety of folks in the conservation community a little worried at this point, in that there's been some talk about potentially releasing farmers from conservation contracts so that they can get in on and essentially put this land back into production. Corn prices are high. There's lots of interest in biofuel for obvious reasons. And if in fact, this rush toward biofuel production starts taking land out of conservation programs or putting land back into production where it has been set aside, then it will have can potentially have some pretty dramatic impacts on wildlife conservation. Yeah. So it's something to watch and something to see what happens at the federal level, but it could have dramatic impacts, both good and bad, depending on which way it goes.
Let's go to William now in Presque Isle. William, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thanks, Larry. Scott, say, by the way, the turkeys are doing very well in Presque Isle. you made a comment, Scott, that I'm going to have to call you to task on relative to those mute swans.
Right.
Larry had a guest on, and I don't believe it was you, but within the last 6 months, it may have been even less time than that, but the gentleman quoted the fact that archaeological evidence, and being a retired archaeologist, I have to be sympathetic in that, that showed there was evidence for the mute swan having been in North America prior to contact.
Well, that's certainly news to me, and it's contrary to anything I've ever seen relative to mute swans, and they're kind of usually categorized in there with European starlings, English sparrows, a whole host of other fauna that essentially came with Eurasian settlement. So I'm not sure. Larry's scratching his head about who the guest might have been.
I'm trying to remember that.
And I certainly can't say, because I don't know who it was, and I don't know the origin of that. There's certainly been many swans in the area historically, both trumpeters and, of course, the whistling or tundra swans that we see passing overhead in the spring and fall in huge numbers and stopping off. But it was my impression that the mute swan was a Eurasian bird which had been brought here by humans.
I'm not remembering the program, unfortunately.
That's my only comment, and I guess we don't have the information, so William and Presque Isle, we're going to have to leave it at that for now.
Thanks for calling. Sarah in New Auburn, we'll go to you. Hi, Sarah.
Hi there. See, I never heard it firsthand, but my dad was talking about that he heard reports of a decreasing population of honeybees. And something else that he had said is that they don't understand why the honeybee population is decreasing or why they're all dying off. And he made another comment that Albert Einstein once predicted that if the honeybee population were to become extinct, that the human population would be extinct in about 4 years. And listening to last hour about the biofuels, depending so much on soybeans and stuff, I'm just wondering what effect that would have, as well as drought and anything else on those crops. And I'll take my answer off here.
All right. Well, I tell you what.
You take the bees, because I think you've probably talked about this.
Yeah,
Phil has.
There is. And as a matter of fact, Phil is going to be updating the bee situation next Wednesday. So he'll be on the show next Wednesday. I know for sure there's a mite that has been discovered that has decimated the honeybee population. And we just haven't been able to deal with that mite as well as we should have. I forget the name of the mite, but Sarah, be sure to tune in next Wednesday, because I know that that's exactly what we're going to be talking about on
and
the show.
And it is a serious problem.
It is
a
serious
problem. A lot of people are worried
about that. Absolutely. Yeah.
And on the flip side, the impacts, I guess the question dealt with in terms of biofuels with agricultural land going back into production, or production being shifted from perhaps some crops to some others, there are certainly lots of important ramifications for agricultural commodities, for land use, for farm values, for wildlife conservation. This is really going to be a big deal, and I think that's why we concluded that it will be worth watching to see how it unfolds.
Yeah. Thanks, Sarah. Be sure to tune in on Wednesday.
Call again.
Thank you very much for calling. Barbara in Pewaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Barb.
Hi. Larry, we have a problem with, first it was cardinals, then it was robins.
Oh, and I'll bet they're banging into your windows.
Banging into the windows, going all around the house, no favorite windows, just any window, over and over and 10, 20 times in a row on the same window, and then on to the next window, leaving their mess behind, their drooling, their worms they're carrying, or whatever.
Oh, boy.
I knew. I've been thinking about this a couple days ago. There was something I didn't like about spring, and now I remember.
This goes on.
Well, yeah, all
I know. I've not had the problem personally, Barbara, but it is a constant source of phone calls and concern during the spring of the year when birds, robins are the most common offender, also cardinals, there are a few others. But the issue here is, as the birds become reproductively active and the male cardinals have been singing now for a week or two, even though it hasn't seemed much like spring, as we get into the bird breeding season, some of these birds, especially those that are living right around homes, see their reflections in the windows. They perhaps not being very bright or maybe just responding to something primeval. They see their reflection. Their interpretation is, oh, my gosh, that's Charlie, the neighbor cardinal, and here he is right in the middle of my territory. So they attack. And when they fall down or flop back into their tree, they look back and, oh, my gosh, Charlie's still there. And they attack again. And, of course, the reflection never goes away, so the attack never stops, and it can become, well, not only can it sometimes be harmful to the bird, but it's a very unbelievably annoying, as I'm sure you would attest to the residents of the home, because it usually starts early in the morning. Now, what to do about it? In some cases, the bird may only be attacking a certain window that has an exposure to the side of the house where it uses most or spends most of its time, or maybe there's only one window that reflects the light just right. And if it's only a window or a certain exposure, usually those windows can be covered with bird netting. It's a very fine mesh, black plastic product that garden centers sell to protect fruit trees, berry bushes, and things like that. And you can drape it down over the window so that it's spaced a few inches away from the window. And that will simply prevent the bird from access to the window pane. And the stuff is so fine that from a few feet away you can't see it. So it's not all that disfiguring as far as the house is concerned. So by covering the window, or in some cases putting a silhouette or something else, or a little soap or some covering that discourages either the reflection, prevents the reflection, or discourages the bird, the problem can be solved. On the positive side, again, in most cases, it's a spring thing related to the breeding season. And if you can tough it out, once that bird's mate has fledged young and they're off on their own, usually the behavior fizzles out. Now, having said all that, which sounds like it's manageable, I've dealt with lots of people like Barbara for whom the problem is much more serious. The bird or birds makes the rounds of the house, attacking virtually every window, and in some cases it may carry on well into the summer. The solutions are still the same, but of course, because there are more windows involved, it's a bigger problem and a bigger issue. It's still the same basic approach, but in some cases, I think it might be worth, for a serious problem, checking with the USDA Wildlife Services office, and the state office is in Sun Prairie, and there's a district office in Waupun and another one in Rhinelander, and just see how they're handling this. I don't know that permits have ever been issued for this particular problem to move or remove the bird, but it's possible, depending on the case the customer can make, I guess, with the Wildlife Services office. They're the ones who handle the permits and the decisions. So that's one extreme possibility. At the other end of the spectrum are the things I described in terms of bird netting, soaping the windows, and so on, or the grin and bear it situation. Some people have actually gone to great lengths on where the bird seems to perch or spend its time. They might put a mirror or a pane of glass out there so the bird's distracted to do battle with its reflection in the mirror, and it forgets about the windows. So those are some of the possibilities, Barbara, but I'm sympathetic, but it's a nasty problem to solve when it gets to involve the whole house.
Yeah. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Emil in Seneca, we go to you next. Hi, Emil.
Hello. I've got kind of a solution for the robins hitting the windows. My wife draws a picture on an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper with a black magic marker of an owl.
Okay.
And tapes it to the window. And we've had the problem every spring, especially in lower windows that are closer to the ground where the robins are feeding, and they happen to look up to see their reflection. But when they see an owl there, they leave the windows alone.
Well,
so we've had it work.
That's certainly one of the possibilities, and in some cases, and yours in particular, it obviously has worked. Those silhouettes, you can draw something and find a silhouette to trace online or whatever. A lot of nature centers actually sell commercial black plastic silhouettes that you can mount or hang in the window of either an owl or a flying raptor, a hawk, and or you can cut them out of black paper. There are a variety of ways, and I think if you did a little web surfing, you could probably find them available commercially online.
Sure,
or
we've seen that work.
The low-tech approach is, again, the piece of paper and the black magic marker once you have a silhouette or pattern to work from. So good luck with that.
I've got another question for you. My reason for calling, we planted trees over a three-year period on 60 acres of what was tillable, about 40,000 stems, and since then, we've noticed an explosion in the population of pheasants just because of habitat, and we're responsible for a food plot, et cetera. Well, at this time of the year now, that food plot's depleted, and we've gotten some pretty heavy snows in Crawford County as well as other parts of the state, but I'm concerned for the pheasants not being able to break through the layers of snow and then the rain on top of the snow and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Does it make sense for me to get a garbage can full of corn from a corn crib and distribute that around the places where I've seen the pheasants moving? And will that help to get them through the next 3 or 4 weeks or however long this snow hangs around?
Well, there are certainly not only the pheasants, but lots of other things that in a setting like that would use that corn, from squirrels to rabbits to a variety of songbirds, blue jays, and the pheasants, of course. But the problem, especially where you described in Crawford County, I guess you need to check first with your local DNR office and see where that is in terms of the county bans on feeding because of chronic wasting disease. Because if you're spreading corn like that on the landscape, although your intentions are honorable and the pheasants would be most appreciative, it could be construed as feeding in an area where feeding has been curtailed or banned because of the disease issue. Because
the deer, I'm talking about a 5-gallon pail here and a 5-gallon pail there, and I've got a 3-acre food plot. So if they're not already congregating somewhere,
trying to pass on the facts of life in terms of in terms of the current problems with feeding because of deer. Mm-hmm. Trying to get the pheasants through is certainly
great.
Is certainly great, and again, I'm sure the pheasants would utilize it. I think with the weather forecast, the way it's coming up, there will be some food plots or windblown fields in south slopes that will open up pretty quickly over the next few days. And because of the relatively mild winter until the snow, I'm guessing the pheasants are in pretty good shape.
Okay.
So
I guess, is corn the right thing to be feeding of? Pheasant at this time of year, or is there something more
appropriate? They would certainly utilize the corn, and if you want to mix in a few sunflowers, it would mix in a 50-pound bag of sunflower seeds with a few bags of corn, then so much the better. But again, I just urge you to make sure you don't run contrary to some regulations because of the deer.
Definitely. Thanks
okay.
very much.
Yep.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And Larry in Hermansville, Michigan, I believe it's your turn. Hi, Larry.
Hi. I'm a veterinarian up here in Upper Michigan, so I get lots of animal questions, but I've never gotten one about frogs. And so I was hoping that Scott could help us out with this. My neighbors have a pond that their cows drink out of, and when they break the ice the last several days or week or so here, there's been just quite a huge number of pollywogs swimming around in the pond water.
Hmm.
And we couldn't figure how that could be this time of the year. And then at the same time, she was asking me if I had heard about some kind of a frog virus or something that's supposed to, like, decimate the frog population. Does Scott know anything about that?
Well, there are some diseases, virus problems, and so forth that have particularly affected leopard frog populations and perhaps others. Let's go back to the polywogs first. Those Michigan frogs are really tough. I mean, breeding now. I think the perception there is, of course, wow, how could this be? I mean, it's barely even a hint of spring. But what happens with some of the larger frog species, green frogs or bullfrogs, if you have them, perhaps even some others, is that they don't have time to metamorphose or essentially make the transition from egg to polywog or tadpole to adult frog in a single warm season, especially the further north you go. So for some of these frogs, it's quite normal for them to overwinter as tadpoles or polywogs and actually complete the metamorphosis to adult frogs in the second summer. So I think that's what's going on there.
Sure.
Is that these are from egg laying and breeding activity last spring, certainly not this spring. And those tadpoles, if they're still thriving now and the ice is going to break up over the next month or so, they should be fine, and there'll be plenty of frogs hopping around come summer. So that's the frog situation or the tadpole situation. And there are good keys now. I mean, if they're curious to know what kinds of frogs they are, there are some good identification keys. The Wisconsin DNR has one that would allow them to identify egg masses if they find them later, or the tadpoles themselves to see what they have. Was the concern over the frog virus a potential health issue for the cattle, or just a curiosity as to whether the frogs would make it or not?
Some of both.
Well, I've certainly never heard of anything that would put cows at risk. Most any small body of water, especially that doesn't have fish in it, will harbor some amphibians. So just about any body of water that cows anywhere are drinking out of probably has some exposure to amphibians. So my gut feeling is that's not a major problem, probably not a problem at all, but it's a little out of my turf. And I don't think that the disease issue that I think is specific to amphibians or frogs is likely to be a problem either.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I told him. But she was concerned about, I don't know, she said something about that we were going to have like sort of silent spring as far as the frogs were concerned because of some kind of a virus or something.
I don't think there are a variety of problems facing amphibians, but the virus issue is not one that's likely to do them in.
Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And, you know, as we hear
What's
this,
that?
We hear the sound of the spring peepers. Isn't that a great sound?
It is a great sound, and I'm looking forward to it very, very dearly after all this snow.
It seems it's a good time, I think, to mention the frog survey that citizens can take advantage of.
Yes, the frog and toad survey has been going on for a long time, some 20, 25 years, and it's a citizen science opportunity. It was put in place, you know, back in the 80s to attempt to get people out on the landscape to survey frogs by listening to the calling and then rating the calling they were hearing in intensity, a few frogs, quite a few frogs, a whole bunch of frogs kind of thing, an index of abundance. And then as people did these survey routes, which were institutionalized and done repeatedly year after year, this began to provide some pretty good information on the status of our frog populations. So the survey is still going strong. It's an opportunity for folks to participate. Lots of people do, and I think there's actually room to sign up if they go to the DNR website and do a little surfing on the website, which is dnr.wisconsin.gov. They can find, and probably through the Bureau of Endangered Resources that administers the survey, adopt a frog survey route near your home and get out there and count those frogs.
And listen to those. Oh, that's a great sound, isn't it?
That's the one that's described as the jingling of sleigh bells in the distance. We'll play some more frog calls when spring makes a real appearance.
Let's take some more calls. Rick in Eau Claire, it's your turn. Hi, Rick.
Morning, Larry. Morning, Scott.
Morning.
Morning.
See, I got two things for you. First of all, I've got a vindictive cardinal in my neck of the woods here, but he only seems to like the mirrors on my Suburban.
Okay.
And the way I went about solving it is I can't even be home from work for a minute. he will see it, and he will immediately come and start pecking on it. So when I pull in the driveway, I shut the door, and I slip on some plain old brown paper garbage bags the grocery store. And I just kind of tape them at the bottom a little bit, and kind of looks like my truck's got earmuffs on it, but keeps them away.
That sounds good. I'm guessing if you just got an old T-shirt or something like that, that would just slip on there pretty easily. And anything like that, the idea is to just eliminate the reflection and the problem goes away. So that's a
good
that's
one.
A creative solution.
And then I do quite a bit of bow hunting. And the 21st of October this year, my brother-in-law and I were hunting down in Durant. Mm-hmm. And we got in quite early. It was probably about 5. And hadn't been in the stand for more than about 10 minutes. And just kind of sitting there. And this god-awful sound came from behind me. And I was up on a ridge, and he was down in the valley below me. So it was up in front of him. And carried on for about 5 minutes. And it was intermittent about every 20 seconds. Mm-hmm. Now, it sounded like a rabbit, but it had more bass to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure what it was, but all I know is when I was sitting in my stand, I grabbed my bow.
Kind of sent a chill down the spine.
It put the hairs on my neck straight up, because I have never heard a sound like that in the woods before. And I told my brother-in-law, I said, I think it's a Yeti, because that's the only thing we could come up with. But one person tells me he thinks it might be a... He said it was a bobcat, and another person told me that it might be a fawn in distress.
Well, Rick, there are so many possibilities that we're not going to be able to give you an answer and say, oh, well, that's what it was, because god-awful sound is while it conveys a certain image, it's not especially descriptive. But we've had this type of call a lot over the years, and I guess I'd say that they're usually traced to sometimes some strange things. The first possibility is a rabbit or some other animal that's in the process of being dismembered by mm-hmm. a predator.
Yeah.
Or badly frightened. A rabbit can make a god-awful sound,
yes.
some horrendous screaming. And, there's some variation in pitch from rabbit to rabbit and animal to animal. But an animal in the midst of a difficult situation is one possibility. Another animal that can make some horrendous screaming is a juvenile owl, particularly a barred owl. And I've had lots of people track down what they thought were children being tortured in the woods or something like that to a couple of hungry young barred owls sitting in a tree begging for mom for something to eat. And then finally, of course, the cats that we have in the state, including bobcats and so forth, can make some pretty impressive screeching and yowling too. So, even a raccoon fight can sometimes create some pretty wretched screaming. So there are enough possibilities, but I'm guessing with the hair standing up, you were disinclined to rush down from the tree and run down there to see what it was. So I guess we're never going to know.
Thanks a lot for calling, Rick. Appreciate it. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening in. Give us a call if you have a question at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Brian in Oshkosh, thank you for waiting. Hi.
Hello. My call concerns the swan conversation from earlier.
Yeah.
And the gentleman called, he said he was a former archaeologist, and he was familiar with some copper or some swan bones being found in archaeological sites,
mm-hmm.
and I'm familiar with that also. One particular site would be the Oconto copper culture site,
mm-hmm.
and I'm quoting right now out of a Wisconsin archaeologist. Interesting artifact types have been found associated with old copper burials. For instance, cut, polished, and incised swan bones,
mm-hmm.
one of which seems to have been a whistle, and that was the one found in Oconto.
Mm-hmm.
Could these have been from Whistler swans, and are Whistler swans native to North America?
Yes. First of all, whistling swans and tundra swans are the same bird. The bird folks decided to change the name back right after I arrived in Wisconsin, and people were saying, oh, look at all those whistling swans, which are now tundra swans. Same bird. And they're very common in Wisconsin, and in some years when we have good snow melt in the spring and there's lots of flooded farm fields and so forth, there'll be flocks of tundra swans all over the place. And I assume that that occurred at the time of these early cultures as well. In addition, the native trumpeter swan, which was more likely to actually breed here, is another possibility.
That these bones were trumpeter bones from trumpeter swans, but I don't have any proof of that.
Well, it certainly, I guess in terms of likelihood, I think because the trumpeter swan nested in Wisconsin, that's the one they were most likely to come in contact with because they were here for a longer period throughout the season. The whistling swans or tundra swans kind of came and went with spring and fall migration, but were certainly also available to early peoples. But the mute swan, again, as I said earlier, I don't believe was here. So it doesn't surprise me at all that there were swan bones used for perhaps a whole variety of native people's uses,
sure,
including whistles and decorations or ceremonial or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So that doesn't surprise me at all, but I'd be mighty surprised to find them traced to mute swans.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Brian, for calling. Appreciate it. And Mark in Madison, we'll go to you. Mark, hi.
Good morning, guys. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Had a question for you. I went cross-country skiing this morning at Token Creek County Park, and on the way back into Madison, this was about an hour ago now, coming along Highway 51 east of the airport, I saw a bald eagle flying overhead.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wondered, how unusual is that in this area, and what type of population might we have of bald eagles here in Dane County?
Well, it's not, well, what should I say? It's not common, but it's not unusual.
Right.
And especially with eagles nearby during the winter in terms of distributed all along the Wisconsin River where they, you know, of course, we have bald eagle days over in Sauk Prairie and so forth, and people go to see the eagles there regularly. I saw one flying around the Arboretum a while ago, and they're certainly around. And this time of year, they're moving back to the north, and there were reports that even a few weeks ago, some eagles had already returned to their nesting territories in northern Wisconsin and were starting mating displays and so forth. So as birds pass through from the further south where they winter, and as birds return to areas along the Wisconsin River, and there are nesting eagles on the lower Wisconsin River now as well, it's certainly something that people will see more of. So it's a neat thing to see, not common, but not rare either.
Sure. Thank you.
Yep. All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Scott, we've have a few things to talk about that we haven't brought up yet. Before we go back to the phones, I did want to mention the tax checkoff.
Mm-hmm.
I've filled my taxes out and put in a chunk of money toward the Endangered Resources Fund or Endangered Species Fund, and mm-hmm. I hope other people will too.
Well, it's been a very popular way for people who are perhaps not in the mainstream of wildlife funding, like buying hunting licenses or other such fees that go toward wildlife conservation. Mm-hmm. So for folks who are so inclined, it's an opportunity on your tax, on your state tax returns, to look for, I think it's still the loon symbol.
Yep.
I don't think it's changed.
No.
Look for the loon symbol, and that's an opportunity to make a voluntary donation. Either you can add to your tax liability or reduce your tax refund, however it happens to work out. But to get some money into the system, into the DNR's Bureau of Endangered Resources, where that money is used for monitoring programs, research programs, a whole host of other activities that contribute to our non-game and endangered and threatened species management.
Yep, absolutely. Bob in Marshfield, we'll go to you now. Hi, Bob.
Hi there. I called in right after deer hunting about a big white bird with black wings, and I didn't know what it was, and you did. I found the name of it. It's a northern, I can't pronounce it, a G-A-N-N-E-T. And just up and down the East Coast, it said. I found that bird in that Kevin Kaufman bird book, and it's really a big bird.
Well, it is a big bird. You're talking about a gannet, which is a seabird. That would, Well, Bob, I wish you had a picture or something of it, because that would certainly be an unusual sighting. But what can I say? If you saw it, I remember you called in, described it quite in quite a bit of detail and got a good look at it. And if you found something in a bird book that satisfies your curiosity, then so be it. But I have a feeling, I don't have the records here in front of me, but I'd be surprised if
Gannet had any other observations.
Gannet had ever been seen in Wisconsin. But
interesting.
Who knows?
Gannet.
Yep.
Gannet. I don't know that bird.
Well, I guess that might lead us into, I just wanted to mention quickly that for people who are seeing unusual birds or want to find out what unusual birds are around or get their bird watching information kind of into the system, so to speak, there was just a news release just came out from the DNR promoting the new eBird website. We talked about this in terms of the National eBird site a month or two ago.
Yes.
But this is eBird, just the letter E, bird.org/WI for Wisconsin, and you can get into this on the internet, and from there you can do all sorts of things. Record your own observations, see what other people are doing, enter a particular bird, see if anybody's seen one in the state lately, find out information on when they arrive, when they depart. It's really for birders. This is kind of the culmination of, I can't imagine things getting much better for birders in terms of information transfer and technology. Now, of course, there are innovations that come down pretty regularly, but this seems like as good as it's ever been and perhaps as good as it can get in terms of being able to share information and have it at your fingertips.
Bob, and thanks again for calling. Appreciate it. Mike in Richland County, it's your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi there. Good program. Thank you. About 5 years ago, when I mowed my pastures, I had leopard frogs just leaping everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Then they just disappeared. I think I saw one last summer. Are they going to come back? What killed them? What happened?
Well, leopard frogs, we talked a little earlier about some disease problems in frogs, and there has been a virus problem with leopard frog populations, among other problems in terms of the way they hibernate. They're vulnerable to drier, colder winters, which we've had recently, and there are other issues with leopard frogs. But your observation is correct. The populations do seem to be dwindling. It used to be that if you walked through just about any meadow or field near a wetland, there were leopard frogs bouncing in every direction.
Yes.
And we moved into our house in 97. I built a water garden in the backyard, and the leopard frogs were there within what seemed like hours. And they were around for a year or two, and I've not seen one in the last 8 years, not a single one.
Is there a comeback anticipated?
Well, you know, a lot of other frogs that were victimized by some of our winter weather patterns and other issues have come back rather nicely. And with pretty good snow cover now, and what will probably be, I hope, good spring runoff and spring rains, frogs have the capability, they're very productive. I mean, an individual female frog lays a lot of eggs. So if things are stacked in their favor for a spring or two, populations can restore themselves very quickly. Whether the leopard frogs will or not, or whether they've been vulnerable to some of these seemingly leopard frog-specific disease problems, that's another matter. And leopard frogs are also at the root of a lot of the conversation over so-called deformed or malformed amphibians.
Uh-huh.
When we see or hear reports of malformed frogs, a frog with six legs or something like that, they very frequently are leopard frogs. So they may be more vulnerable to those problems as well.
I see.
But you're right. They've become a whole lot more scarce than they once were.
Yeah. Thanks for calling, Mike. Appreciate it. Tom in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. How are you folks doing today?
Great.
I hope well. I have a question about birds. I'd love to see a snowy owl, and that one has eluded me on my life list. So can you tell me where might is this an interruptive year? I have not heard.
Well, we've actually, I haven't heard in the last couple of weeks, but there's been one sitting on a construction crane right here on the east end of campus for most of the winter, sitting perched on the end of a building construction site, and there have been all sorts of pictures circulating in the local papers and internet. So there have been a few around the Madison area and up at the Audubon Society's Goose Pond Sanctuary just north of Madison, but this is exactly, Tom, what we were just talking about in terms of this eBird website, that you can go to this website and literally get up to date information on who's seeing snowy owls where, like right now, and that gives you the opportunity to hop in the car and zoom off to one of these sites and add that bird to your life list.
Got you. Read my mind. Thank you.
There you go.
Right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And Elaine in Appleton. Hi, Elaine.
Well, hello. I live in the city, and we have some trees in a garden here. And a couple of years ago, I saw a giant toad in my flower bed. And then last fall, we saw the toad, we think was the same one, in a hole covered with leaves. Now, I'm wondering how I can encourage him, because we rather like to have him stay around. I have no water beds or any, or water gardens.
Well, you know, toads move around, disperse around the landscape from where they reproduce. They are amphibians, even though they have relatively dry skin compared to most other amphibians, and they do very well in a dry environment. They really only move to water for reproduction in the spring. And then they scatter far and wide across the landscape, and when the little tiny ones emerge from the ponds and marshes and so forth in late summer, they're about the size of your fingernail, and they too disperse around the landscape. So the closer you are to one of these breeding sites, the more likely toads will get to your area. They will overwinter in burrows and under decks and wood piles and things like that. So if either that individual or others are still around and made it through the winter, then you're likely to see them again, or others may take its place. In terms of what you can do to encourage them, other than perhaps putting in a water garden feature where you might actually get them to breed, as they do in my water garden, leaving some thick mulch, loose soil, things like that that can get down in amongst and hide and so forth are really about all you can do, and I think we're about to break.
We are. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, Larry Mueller here. Give us a call. We have some open lines if you'd like to join in at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Give a call. Scott, there's a turkey permit sale I mentioned earlier. I think it's March 23rd for people who did or did not get a permit earlier.
Yeah, it doesn't matter what you did or didn't get in the drawing. Of course, some of us are in the didn't get category, but in any event, the unallocated permits, which generally are for later in the hunting zone or hunting time frame, later in the spring, there are a bunch of those still available for a lot of different turkey hunting units. So if somebody either forgot to apply or didn't draw, they have a chance here on March 23rd to either online or at the DNR service centers or whatever, go in and at I guess the rate of one a day. For I think it's $10, you can still get a turkey permit and then be able to hunt this coming spring. And even if you got a permit, you can still buy additional ones and be able to hunt mm-hmm. in several periods or take several birds.
And I also mentioned the cougar photos. And before we go to Phil for the next call here, there have been a rash of cougar photos on the internet.
Well, they do circulate with some regularity, and they tend to cycle around. You know, you'll see one, and then a year later, it'll come back again with the claim that it was same picture,
yeah.
but it was taken in some other state at some other time. There was one notorious one of a cougar following a mule deer next to a ponderosa pine tree, which means it was obviously in the West, but it's been attributed to 10 different states. But one of the more recent ones was attributed to an anonymous submission of this photograph from northeastern Wisconsin. And I know it shows the animal walking through a backyard toward a bird feeder in what appears to be a perfectly normal Northwoods setting. So
yeah.
we don't know much more about that one or why it was. I mean, perhaps the individual was concerned about the cougar's well-being, didn't want to specify the location or details, but that one looked like it certainly was a cougar,
mm-hmm.
and it certainly looked like northern Wisconsin. So there's some merit there, and then there's another series that have been going around of a cougar on someone's deck, kind of looking in the patio door, which is a little nerve-wracking, but that one, I've seen that attributed now to it being taken in 10 different states, one of which was not Wisconsin. So you have to take a lot of stuff. Between Photoshop and the internet, it's pretty hard to believe a picture anymore.
Yeah, it's too bad in a way. Phil in Hebron, Illinois, thanks for waiting. Hello.
Yeah, thank you for letting me join your wild kingdom, guys.
Sure.
I have a quick question for you, Scott. I grow plants in polyethylene slick greenhouses, and two summers ago, I had a frog, I'll tell you, it was about the size of a quarter, legs and everything, that had suction cups on his feet, and he would walk right up the plastic greenhouse. Mm-hmm. What was that?
Well, that was a gray tree frog in all probability, although as far as our native tree frogs are concerned, there are actually a couple species of gray tree frog, but I'm trying to think of how I'd describe it. Sorting out which one it was probably isn't important. The point is we do have native tree frogs. They have the little pads on the end of their toes, and they could certainly walk up a vertical surface. On my garage, they cling to the end of the garage near the mercury vapor light at night and catch bugs, and they walk freely up and down the house as if it was a horizontal surface. They can be either bright pea green or kind of a dark grayish mottled color that mimics tree bark and anything in between. So that's probably the animal. However, if you grow plants, are these all native plants? Do you import or buy any stock?
I bring plants in from all over the world, and that's my question.
Okay.
This is something I would expect to see at the maybe down at the Field Museum or something. It kind of surprised me, and I wondered if I introduced something or if somebody came to see me.
Well, chances are the animal came. It could have been a native tree frog. That's one issue. But it also could have been something introduced on the plant material. A few years ago, right here on campus, in some of the campus research greenhouses, all of a sudden a lot of tiny little frogs started to crop up, and it was after one of the tropical plant sales, and they turned out to be or were ultimately identified as a Cuban tree frog, certainly not native to this area, and something that was hitchhiking on the plants or in amongst the foliage. So it's certainly possible that you've inadvertently gotten some exotic tree frog of some kind, and I have no idea what.
Well,
but
possible. I'll watch to see if it's a native again. How big am I going to look for a maximum frog in that? How big is it going to be?
A good size, a really robust tree frog could be the diameter, as it's sitting tightly with its legs drawn in, could be the diameter of a 50-cent piece.
Okay, because I'm assuming he'll have a good life. Our greenhouses are 28 degrees all mm-hmm. winter. So if he went in there, he probably thinks he was on vacation anyway, so I'll keep an eye open.
If you happen to see it, you could either capture it and we could have a look at it or take a digital picture of it and send it to us. It'd be an interesting curiosity.
Good deal. I'll watch for him. Thanks for the help, man.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And Kate at Appleton, your turn. Hi, Kate.
Hi, good morning. I have a question. My mom and I have been watching this owl's nest. She lives right here on the Fox River in Appleton, mm-hmm. and there's great birds. There's eagles and all kinds of water birds. But we noticed this nest and could clearly get a very, very, very clear picture of this great horned owl in there. And she was on her nest every day for 3 weeks, and depending on the weather, you know, sometimes she would get up and move a little bit around and look the other way. And we have a scope on her from upstairs, and downstairs you can just see her really well with binoculars.
Mm-hmm.
And at first we were thinking it can't be the right season. But, you know, kind of the more we asked around, it seems to be okay that it's this season.
Oh, absolutely. The great horned owls have been nesting for weeks.
Okay, well, now here's the problem. She's gone. And how serious is that? And does it mean it's over or?
Well, given the weather, you know, it was darn near zero yesterday morning. So if the owl had eggs and abandoned the nest, then I'm sure the eggs haven't made it. But there are a variety of possible explanations. The owl was disturbed. It was and left, abandoned the nest. A predator got in and got the eggs. Maybe the owl. Do you still see the owl at all, or is the owl gone?
We have not seen her.
Well,
an accident
could have befallen the owl. It could have been hit by a car. There are a whole host of things that could have happened, but it's certainly possible. It's very likely that the bird was nesting, and that's not at all unusual. They start this activity in January in most years. Mm-hmm. So the owlets either could have hatched already or should have soon. But the only way to know perhaps what happened is to have a look at the nest somehow at some point and see whether there are eggs left in there. Although if the eggs were abandoned, I don't think it would take a raccoon long to find them, and they'd be gone anyway. But the point is, in all likelihood, that nest has failed. For what reason, we'll never know. But, you know, they may be back there again in future years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Thanks very much. Appreciate the call. We've gotten some emails, Scott, too. Dave in Milwaukee emailed us to say the vet who called about frogs was probably referring to the fungal disease chytridiomycosis, I believe it's pronounced.
I think it's called red leg, usually.
Yeah, it threatens to wipe out about a third to half of the 6,000 species of frogs and possibly thousands of uncatalogued species. It fungus attacks the keratin on a frog's leg and damages the waterproofing. And David learned this on an NPR program three weeks ago. And then gannets, emailed in to say that the bird that relates to the bird question from our caller earlier, normally found along the northeast coast up to St. Lawrence. They winter in the Caribbean and even across to the Canary Islands. According to an old Palmer natural history book, they were reported in Michigan in the late 1940s.
Hmm.
Palmer was from Cornell. It's quite possible that gannets could make it further into the Great Lakes.
Well.
So there's one more, and then one from Jim Christopoulos, who is with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. And he goes back to the discussion on mute swans. He was intrigued by this prospect, which went against any scientific information he'd ever encountered, and in terms of them
in
being
in terms of
here,
the archaeological?
Yeah.
Okay.
He says he's found no reliable information backing up the claim that they were a native species.
Okay, good. Well, we're supported and expanded there. So again, we thank the legions of well-educated and informed listeners out there. And on that subject, if you wouldn't mind, I bumped into a friend and colleague last night at the Wildlife Society meeting,
right,
who had convinced his hunting group up in the Rice Lake area to listen in, and they've become faithful listeners. So hello to all you folks up in Rice Lake, whether you're new or old-time listeners.
Yeah,
thanks.
And thanks a lot for listening. I have fond memories of Rice Lake. I did some of my doctoral research in Rice Lake, so I like that town. Maureen in Oshkosh, it is your turn. Hi, Maureen.
Hi. My question is about goldfinches. I always assumed that in the fall they migrated south like the robins do.
Mm-hmm.
But my neighbor says they're always here. They stay here and they just change color.
Well, right on both counts, I guess. You know, some do move out of the area, but some remain around and they do turn color. The brilliant yellow and black that we see in the breeding season or in the summer, when lots of people call them wild canaries because of that brilliant yellow, that is breeding season plumage. And for the winter period, kind of a drab olive brown and not particularly attractive. And, you know, if you weren't paying attention, you'd never recognize them as a goldfinch. But I've had goldfinches at my little feeding station outside the office window up in northern Wisconsin off and on all winter. So they
cool.
do remain around.
Okay.
Thanks, Maureen.
All right, thanks.
And take some more calls. You can join, by the way. We've got some open lines. We'll get you on pretty fast at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. And now we'll turn to John in Nina. John, hi.
Hi, how are you folks?
Great, thanks for calling.
That's wonderful. The devastation of the crane project this past winter, would you care to comment on that, please?
I assume you're referring to the loss of the 17 cranes by
right.
those unfortunate
right.
storms in Florida, and it's not a fatal blow. The project has been going very well. There are cranes established in Florida now. There are cranes moving back and forth. For folks unfamiliar with this, this was the case of the entire cohort this year of young whooping cranes that had been led south by ultralight aircraft from central Wisconsin to the refuge in Florida. All had made it, I think for the first time, that they had yeah. all made it without incident. And then shortly after arrival, those freak storms that caused all sorts of devastation in Florida literally killed all but I think one of them. Maybe all of them, but I think there was some speculation
one got away.
That one had survived. So it was... it was a disaster, and that's literally, it was a natural disaster, unpredictable, probably unpreventable in terms of protecting the swans. It just came up so fast, and no one expected anything like that could happen. So it's one of those bumps in the road that the program and everybody fond of the restoration of the whooping cranes will just have to get over.
Will it be, can can they pick up where they lost up here now? Or?
Sure. There'll be another cohort of birds, and they'll continue with the project, and the birds that are already established will presumably continue to grow a new population, which was the goal in the first place. So it was a setback, and it was unfortunate, and it was tragic, but it was not much more than
it
that.
Wasn't
it
fatal.
Wasn't a fatal blow to the program.
Yeah. Thanks, John, for calling. Grant in Plover, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Grant.
Hi, how are you? Great show.
Thanks.
I want to report an owl sighting. It was a snowy owl along Highway 10 as I was returning from Appleton to Plover. This was a couple of months ago now, but it was right around the holiday season, and I think it was in the area of Wapaka, mm-hmm. kind of near where the Wapaka River is there. Just off the highway, sitting on a fence post.
Huh.
And then another observation regarding goldfinches that you were talking about a minute ago. All winter long, I've had my feeders out full of sunflowers and full of thistle and no birds, very few birds, until the recent snow.
Mm-hmm.
And now my feeders are full. Birds. I can't keep seed in there
mm-hmm.
enough. So just an observation that they must have had plenty to eat until the snowfall.
Yeah.
Yeah, in an open winter, the kind of mild winter that it looked like we were going to have, the birds are quite capable of taking care of themselves and may or may not use feeders. But once things got a little tough, they were right there. But I guess the trail's a little cold on that snowy owl, so we better not recommend that Tom hop in the car to go see that one. But
it is kind of interesting. Most of the sightings, and I went to the Wisconsin eBird, most of the sightings occur in January, February, March, April, and then again in November, December. So, might still be some around. Scott in Wanakee, it's your turn next. Hi, Scott.
Good afternoon. We live in Wanakee, and we live kind of out in the country, and we have 16 acres. Part of it's an old abandoned quarry, so it's kind of rough and overgrown and brushy. But last spring, about 5 o'clock in the morning, I let the dog out. She's 95-pound lab. Relatively aggressive towards other dogs. I've never seen her back down from anything. But she was in the backyard barking away at something, and she would not cry. I could see her kind of through the lights outside, but I couldn't see what she was barking at. And she wouldn't cross a certain line. And then I went outside to tell her to stop barking because I just figured it was a raccoon or a squirrel or something. And while she was barking, something, I swear, growled back at her. And it was a deep, very guttural growl. I know we have coyotes in the area, but I can't see them making the noise like this, and I can't see her backing down from a coyote either. Just wondering if you guys had any ideas what that could have been.
Well, no idea really, other than to explore the possibilities, and a growl could have come from a coyote, and there may have been more than one. They often are in packs and so forth. There may have been just some animals you couldn't see, and that's what it was. I think what you might be headed for, because of the deeper growl, is it possible there was a wolf in the area? And
yeah. Doubtful, isn't it?
It's pretty doubtful. It's a long shot, but not impossible. I mean, those animals really can cover the ground, and there have been road-killed wolves in this area or in southern Wisconsin. So we learned a long time ago in this program to never say never and to never rule out any possibility. But I think the likely possibilities, wolf's a long shot, coyote maybe a little more likely, stray dog, neighbor's dog that growled back, and the dog simply...
She wouldn't go near that point for the next day and a half or 2 days. She wouldn't cross that line. So I've seen her tangle with neighbor's dogs before they came onto the property.
Yeah. My lab is of similar size, but apparently a little bit of a wimp, because if she's frightened by something or hears something she doesn't understand, she'll back off and bark and growl and avoid it. But it may prove to be little more than a leaf blowing in the wind when you finally explore it. But certainly some of those larger or other canids are a possibility. Even a big old raccoon can do a fair bit of threatening growling.
Yes.
Under some circumstances. So,
Scott, I ran through the flashlight and I couldn't find what it was, and I didn't see any tracks. So.
No. Hard to say.
Well, you're lucky to have an old quarry. Are there any snakes around that quarry?
We've seen a few grass snakes, lots of frogs, but it dries up once the summer heat comes. So
I was just wondering, sometimes those old quarries are great hibernation sites for snakes, and you see a lot of them in the spring before they disperse, but just curious.
I haven't seen a lot of those, no.
Okay. Okay. Thanks, Scott.
Thanks.
And Dick in Appleton, I believe, is next. Dick, hello to you.
Yeah, fine. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We've seen, I live on the Fox River, and we've had blue herons since the 24th of February. Are those some who just stayed, or early birds, or what? I'll take my answer off the phone.
Well, it could be either one. Generally, they hung around for a long time this year because it stayed mild for so long.
Right.
And a lot of things didn't look like some of the lakes around Madison were ever going to freeze. So there are herons still around, and as long as you've got open water, as you do along the river system, I think it's probably even more likely that they were birds that hung on all winter rather than birds that are coming back now. As they tend to, most of the birds tend to come back more slowly in the spring as they follow the 32-degree isotherm, the thaw line north, whereas they make a longer, quicker flight in the fall of the year.
Yeah.
So I think it could be either one, but I think it's more likely they just hung on there and found enough of a food supply to keep them going.
With those birds on the way, it's probably, if anybody's thinking about birdhouses, not a bad time to put some together or purchase or build your own. Or
it's a good time to do a couple of things. One, if you've got birdhouses out there, it's time to do a little maintenance. We're kind of entering the mud season now when you can't do much outside. So get those birdhouses and first roust the mice out of them, clean out the mouse nests, and do any repairs on the houses and get them back up. But then in addition, as you said, if you'd like to add a few boxes or put some up if you don't have them, there are really good plans available for building things in the shop, which is a good late winter project. Extension has a good publication called Shelves, Houses, and Feeders for Birds and Mammals. And the Minnesota DNR's publication, Woodworking for Wildlife, is very nice, too. So you can build them. You can certainly buy them. There are mm-hmm. many stores now that sell bird and birding and mm-hmm. bird material. So you can buy them, build them, renovate what you have. But get some birdhouses out there this time of year.
All right. Doe in Williams Bay, hi to you.
Hi. A quick question. We usually see a robin at a time in spring coming to visit, and the last week my daughter called me to the window and there was a whole flock of robins. Do they do that?
Yes, we looked out the window back a week ago Friday, which was the second day of that first big snowstorm. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it was howling around my house and snow everywhere.
Uh-huh.
And I said, "That looks like a robin in the birch tree. There's another one." There were between 20 and 50 running around the backyard, and they were utilizing the high bush cranberries that were still on the shrubs and the dried apples that were still hanging on the trees in my little apple orchard. They were there for an hour or two and then gone. So there are a couple things with robins. They will start to move north fairly early, but there are also a number of places, especially around lakes and rivers, where some flocks will overwinter in Wisconsin. So it could have been either one.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And David in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi.
Hi, Larry, and hi, Scott. Just a quick comment. We've been seeing a few gray foxes around Wisconsin Rapids lately, and we had one out by our hunting shack near Pittsville. Got a picture of it with a motion detection camera. Told my neighbor about it, whose camera I had borrowed. He said, "Well, I've got another one." And he had a picture of this gray fox in a tree, climbing mm-hmm. a tree just like a squirrel. Now, I knew that foxes, the gray foxes, would climb a tree, but I don't know if you've ever seen one.
I've not seen one personally climbing, but gray foxes are known for being one of the few members of the dog family, one of the few canids that's a reasonable climber. So it's that's pretty good documentation. That'd be a nice picture. If they want to email it to me, I wouldn't object to that. But they're a beautiful animal, not commonly seen, but they do climb, which is unusual for dog-like animals.
Yeah.
Well, I'll email a picture down to you.
That'd be great.
Thank you.
And appreciate your call very much. And Scott, always a pleasure. We'll come back in another month. And in another month, hopefully the weather will be a lot different here in Wisconsin.
Yes. Well, that was a fast hour and a half. So lots of good calls. Thank you.
Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest today. Always fun. And he'll be back the first Wednesday of next month. Coming up tomorrow at 11, we'll be visiting with John Merrill, Professor Emeritus in the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison. And, of course, As is always the case, he'll have some advice on home renovation and repair issues. And maybe we can end with some spring peepers. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.